Hey, readers and writers. Welcome to episode 115, where we're going to do something a little different. In case we haven't met before, I'm Deb. And my partner in crime won't be joining us, because I swear she is the busiest woman in the universe. So to make up for the fact that you have to listen to my voice the entire time, I thought I'd read you a story. And not just any story, my story. The title is Dark Inheritance, and it's currently available on Kindle Vella. We'll be reading the first 6 episodes, and if you like it, check out the rest of the story over there. If you don't like it, drop me a line on Twitter and let me know why. I'm not a delicate flower. I'm always open to feedback. So without further ado, here's my story, Dark Inheritance. Oh, wait, before we launch into this, I want to put out there that while the setting is heavily influenced by my grandparents' farm, this story is fiction. I made all of it up. All the people, places, situations, they're all just products of my brain. Having said that, let's get started. Chapter 1, Kate. The Dead End sign was thick with rust. Eaten by decades of harsh winters, that far out into the country, there were no street signs, only numbers on a map, and the sign was the only outward indication that Reese Hill Road existed. Kate touched the brakes and turned the car onto the dirt road. As the car passed over the stone bridge that spanned the width of Reese Creek, an electric chill ran down her arms, raising the fine hairs there and making her shiver despite the cloying August heat. "Promise me," the memory of her mother whispered. "Promise me you'll never go back." Kate shook her head, trying to rid herself of the phantom pressure of her mother's cold fingers, and did her best to resist the urge to touch the locket that hung around her neck. "She's dead," she said to the empty car. "I don't have a choice." But like every conversation she had with her mother's ghost, it was filled with half-truths. Ahead of her, the road rose and disappeared into the dark trees that choked the lane and spilled their shade over the packed earth. The small rental rumbled over the uneven surface, protesting as she urged it to climb higher. Memories that had lain dormant woke as the car made its way up the road. Waiting for the bus on her first day of school, walking the forest paths with her grandmother, picking wild strawberries under the hot summer sun. Each memory burst within her mind with bright recognition, but then faded just as swiftly, leaving a sour taste in her mouth. She fingered the locket and wondered if anyone else regretted their childhood as much as she regretted hers. The car passed the Clark farmstead. The wide porch sagged beneath a heavy roof, and a once cheery yellow paint was peeling. It watched her pass silently. Kate concentrated on the road in front of her and the fallow fields that lingered on the left side of the road, sloping down towards the waiting forest line. The hill was like 100 other hills that rolled across the countryside, low and mounding with patchwork fields, only things didn't grow right on Reese. Most of the farming families had left long ago, preferring to start over somewhere else than fight against the encroaching forest. The Clarks were one of the few that had stayed. When the trees at last fell back and the small white house Kate was born in came into view, something inside her deflated as the hope she hadn't realized she'd been harboring dissipated in a rush of tarnished memory. She gripped the steering wheel tight as she guided the little car into the half-moon driveway. Keeling the engine, she leaned down to look up at the house through the passenger window. Her past stared back at her through the small, darkened windows, and Kate shivered. She grabbed her phone from the passenger seat and opened her door, stepping out into the August afternoon and leaving the car keys in her backpack behind. The humidity rushed to greet her, pressing against the exposed skin of her arms and legs. She sucked in a deep breath, filling her lungs with the thick, warm air. Her aunt's words came back to her, unbidden, like trying to breathe water. Shoving her phone into her back pocket of her cutoffs, she started up the slab stairs that were set into the sloping hillside, skipping the white one out of habit. High above, the sun was bright in a cloudless sky and its heat beat down, soaking through the thin cotton of her t-shirt and warming the skin beneath. Ahead, the house waited for her, a reproving mother. It was squatter than she remembered. Everything was. In spite of all the awful things that had happened there, she couldn't stop thinking about how everything seemed smaller. She could have reached up and touched the porch ceiling if she wanted. The memory of her 7-year-old self hadn't accounted for the growth of years. The front door had been painted green in her youth, but someone had covered that memory with a thick coat of red that was so dark it was almost black. It gleamed in the shade of the porch like freshly poured tar, and unlike the jolly green of her childhood, there wasn't even a hint of welcome. Instead, it stood like a guard, foreboding, radiating from the glossy brushstrokes. Kate dug in her pocket for the key Chief Shannon had given her that morning. It felt too small in her hand, the single key without a key ring, like it was only part of a whole. She opened the screen door and looked at the lock in front of her. There was no deadbolt, nothing to confuse where this key belonged, only the single brass knob set into the sea of blood. She fit the key into its waiting lock. It slid in smoothly, gliding over the pins inside. Almost too easy. She grasped the knob, and as her hand closed over the cool metal, a flash of memory jolted through her. Her grandmother standing in this doorway, hair and eyes wild as she watched Kate and her mother run down the steps to the waiting car. "You can never come back!" Her voice had slashed the thick night air, cut a scorching line of derision down Kate's back, but her mother had never looked back. Now, standing there with her hand on the doorknob, cold nausea swept through Kate's body, making her sun-warm skin suddenly clammy. She breathed in sharply through her nose as her stomach writhed in its cage. "She can't hurt you anymore," her mother whispered from some long-forgotten memory. Kate exhaled noisily and closed her eyes, knowing she was being ridiculous. "It's just a house," she said to the empty porch and turned the knob. It was a smell that hit her first and transported her back to her childhood. Hot wood baking under the summer sun, furniture polish, and the mix of herbs that she would forever associate with her grandmother. Thyme, peppermint, and rosemary. Strength, healing, and memory. Though Kate was hard-pressed to remember her grandmother ever healing anyone. The front door opened into the main room of the house, both kitchen and living space. One end was dominated by the huge wooden table, and the other by a couch that had been old when Kate lived there 15 years earlier. It was a lot to take in at once, so many memories clamoring for space, but it was the cardboard boxes that were littered about the room that ultimately won her attention. She frowned and peered into one that was left on the corner of the table. It was mostly filled with books and a few knickknacks. She recognized her grandfather's ancient wildflower field guide along the contents. Kate plucked it from the box and turned it over in her hands. It was bound in butter-soft green leather, and she ran her fingers over the well-loved cover, remembering all the times she'd flipped through its pages. She looked up at the other boxes that were scattered around the room. Why had her grandmother been packing away her things? Cat Dane had treasured her husband's field guide. It was only then, as Kate scrutinized the room, she realized she could see a slice of the backyard to the doorway that led into the pantry. The back door was open. Chapter 2. Tad. Tad took another sip of his coffee and eyed the scene in front of him. "Run me through it again, Bobby," he said. Not because he didn't understand the first time, but rather because he thought there was no way he could have heard it right. The older man rubbed his bushy ginger brown beard. "We think it touched down here." He turned and waved his hand to the carnage behind them. "Then there was an explosion, probably the propane tank behind the house," he said, pointing past the black crater. Tad set his coffee on the hood of his squad car and exchanged it for the 5-page report he'd taken from the office. His arm ached, and he shifted it ever so slightly in the sling, trying to ease the pressure. "So, just to clarify, you're saying a tornado wiped out the house?" Bobby nodded defensively, a curt upward thrust of his chin. "Yeah, that's our best guess." "Then," Tad continued, "the propane exploded." Bobby nodded along. It was like he couldn't hear how insane the theory sounded, even when Tad repeated it back to him. "And then what?" Tad asked. "The tornado just up and disappeared?" He couldn't censor the disbelief that colored his voice. Bobby frowned at him, and Tad got the impression that he'd managed to insult him. "It ain't unheard of." His frown deepened. "Why are we even doing this? Your dad already cleared it." Tad clenched his jaw. "I just want to get things clear in my head. I wasn't on scene." "Yeah, I heard about that. How's your arm?" Tad hefted the sling by way of response. "It's okay. Doc's got me on painkillers and antibiotics. Truck's totaled, though." Bobby clucked his tongue in sympathy. "Tough luck, man." Tad nodded. "So, about this theory, you gotta admit it's pretty damn implausible." He expected some kickback, brace for it even, but it never came. Bobby just shrugged. Maybe, but there's an eyewitness. That grabbed Tad's attention. Seriously? He flipped awkwardly through the report. That's not in here. He looked back up at Bobby. Who? Bobby pointed east to a house. From this distance, Tad could just make out the line of roof. Neighbor saw the whole thing. Okay, Tad said, setting the report on the hood and reaching for his pen. What's their name? Bobby shrugged apologetically. Don't know, kid. Not my job. Tad sighed and ran his hand over his face, feeling the stubble on his cheeks. He should have shaved that morning. All I know is she's the one who called it in. All right, I'll sort it out. Any word on Clint? When's he coming around today? Bobby shrugged again, this time less apologetically. Teddy Pelton's barn burnt down this morning over on Harper's Road. Once he's done over there, he'll head back this way. Tad nodded half to himself. That meant there would be a couple hours at least if Clint managed to get there at all that day. Thanks, Bobby. No problem. Need me anymore? I gotta head back to the office and pick up some forms for Clint. No, thanks for coming. Bobby nodded and headed for his truck. Then he paused and turned back to Tad. I suppose it goes without saying, but don't go down into the wreckage, he said. Those beams are unstable. Lyle's coming by tomorrow to lift him out with the crane. Till then, no one goes down there. Tad didn't think he'd be able to climb into the crater with his arm the way it was, but he smiled and waved his thanks anyways. He watched Bobby pull out of the drive before cautiously approaching the crater's edge. Carefully balancing on the loose stones that sat on the edge, he looked down into the hole. It was filled with debris and blackened beams. Half of a melted doll's face peered at him from the bottom of the wreckage. His mind went back to the report still in his hand. Haven and Abigail Dane, aged 3 and 5. Sourness bloomed in his stomach. It was one thing when it was just a fact written on paper, but it was a whole other ballgame when the evidence was right in front of his face. He turned, his weight pushing some of the stones into the hole, and collected his things off the hood of the squad car. He eyed the house in the distance. In the end, it took him more time to get in and out of his car than it did to drive up the road to the neighboring house. Before he got out of the car, he double-checked the report. There was no mention of an eyewitness. It barely mentioned the 911 call at all. He could only guess why the witness's name was left off the report. It was probably because his dad had either neglected to follow up the 911 call or forgotten her name and was just covering it up. Either way, Tad fumed. It made him look like an asshole in front of the fire marshal's office. He picked up the radio. Hey, Carla? He waited a minute for her to respond. After 30 seconds or so, the line crackled to life. What's up, Dad? She asked, her smoker's voice deepened by the cheap hardware. My dad around? Just stepped out for lunch with Jeb. Need me to call him up? Her unspoken question hung in the air. Was Tad in over his head? He shook his head, even though she couldn't see him. No, I'll talk to him when I get back. He hesitated, not sure if he should, then plunged ahead anyways. Hey, there's some information missing from the report about the 911 call for the Dane fire. Do you know anything about that? He held his breath, waiting for her rejection. Wasn't on duty, kid, she said, her voice clipped. Yeah, he pressed, but didn't my dad say anything about it? The line was silent, and he wondered if he'd pushed her too far. Can't remember that he did, she eventually answered. Her voice was like an arctic wind, and he grimaced, alone in his car. He'd taken it too far. Okay, thanks, he said brightly, trying to back out of the corner he'd painted himself into. I was just wondering. I'm on my way to check on it now. I should be back in the office in an hour or so. Okay, she said, her voice distant and coldly professional. He sighed and signed off. He should put in for a transfer to another station. It was bad enough that his dad was chief, but those guys were already a functioning unit before he got there. When he was a kid, he was practically their mascot, but now that he was a real officer, they looked at him like he was the fucking enemy. He looked at the house through the dirty windshield. It reminded him of a larger version of his grandpa's cabin up at the lake, with a deep porch and a high-pitched sweeping roof. Only this roof was set with solar panels, and there were cherry tomatoes and hanging pots where his grandpa had wind chimes. The small handmade sign next to the door read, Calhoun. The woman who opened the door was well past middle-aged, but wore it well. Can I help you? She asked, pushing an unruly lock of curly hair out of her face. "Afternoon, ma'am," he said, affecting his most wholesome good old boy charm. "I'm Officer Shannon of the East Huntington Police Department. I want to talk to you about the incident next door." She gave him a critical once over and then peered beyond him at the squad car parked in the driveway. "You got a badge?" "Yes, ma'am," he said, fishing it out of his pocket. She glanced at it with pursed lips. "How come you're not in uniform?" He motioned to the sling. "I'm still on temporary medical leave, but since the office is short-staffed, I'm helping out where I can." "What happened?" "Dear," he said simply. She nodded in understanding, then stepped aside and let him enter. The house was a veritable jungle filled with green things. What wasn't growing in pots was hanging dried from the wide beams that ran along the ceiling. It smelled like old incense, spicy and stale at the same time. The woman walked back to the island that separated the kitchen from the living space and picked up a big spoon. "Well," she said, as she stirred the big pot that was simmering on the stove, "it took you long enough. I thought I was going to have to go over there and take care of it by myself." Startled, he looked away from the plants, not sure he'd heard her correctly. "Come again?" The woman eyed him. "You're here about Rich and Ann's place, right?" To his credit, he didn't consult the report in his pocket. "Richard Dane, that's right. They tell me you're the one that called 911. She nodded, saw the whole thing. "Want to tell me about it?" he asked, pulling his notebook out of his breast pocket. She gave the pot a final stir and then set the spoon on the counter beside the stove. "You want something to drink?" she asked, pulling open a cupboard and pulling down a set of glasses. He shrugged before he remembered the action with hurt. "Sure," he said, setting his notebook down at her coffee table and massaging his shoulder. She set a glass of iced tea in front of him and then settled herself in one of the armchairs that flanked the table. He took his cues from her and sat on the couch. It was an old wicker piece that creaked under his weight and smelled like dead roses. She watched him with a sharp gaze. "What do you know?" He tilted his head and considered her question. "Why don't we start with your name and what happened to make you call 911? That'll give me a better idea of where we stand." Chapter 3, Kate. "Hello?" she called tentatively, putting the book down on the table and turning back around to the room. Above her head, something or someone moved upstairs. The floorboards creaked under their weight. "Who's there?" she asked the ceiling. Her voice sounded thin and frightened to her own ears. The ceiling didn't answer. A moment passed, and then the thing upstairs moved and the creaking resolved in the footsteps. She moved to the foot of the stairs and craned her neck to look up. The L-shaped stairwell prevented her from seeing the top, but the white ceiling, made brilliant by the south-facing windows, chased away the fear that clung like spiderwebs and emboldened her. "Hello?" she called again. "Who's there?" A man's face, pinched in line with age, appeared over the banister above her head, and she jumped. "Who are you?" he demanded. "Kate," she said automatically, the word tumbling out of her mouth before she could think better of it. His face stilled, the sneer that lingered above his lips dissolving. He stood up, disappearing from her view. She heard him walk around to the top of the stairs. "Who are you?" she asked the empty stairwell. "And what are you doing in my grandmother's house?" "I could ask you the same thing," he said, coming down the stairs. He was carrying another cardboard box, and he was taller than she expected, lean and lanky like a praying mantis. Beneath ashen hair streaked with gray, his face was long with sharp, hawkish features. He scowled at her, pushing his yellowing acrylic glasses further up his nose with a finger that was stained with nicotine. Something about him spoke of danger, and she backed up, eyeing him warily. His scowl twisted into a predatory smile. "Who are you?" she asked again. "I'm hurt you don't remember Uncle Henry," he mocked. Her mind flew through the list of relations she could remember. "I don't have an Uncle Henry." "Yes, you do," he countered, moving past her and setting the box he carried on the table next to the field guide. "Or didn't Maggie tell you? I married your Aunt Susan." The casual use of her mother's name was deliberate. "You knew my mother?" He flicked a glance at her and picked up the discarded field guide. "I grew up with Susan and Richard." He put the book back into the box. "Maggie was like a little sister to me." Kate looked around the room. It suddenly felt vast and alien. She glanced back at the open door to the little red rental car she could see beyond. Here was her chance to leave, to put this whole awful chapter of her life behind her forever. Someone else was there to clean up the mess. She should feel relief. She didn't. "You don't have to worry about it anymore," he said, as if reading her thoughts. "I'm taking care of things." She swung her gaze back to him. He was watching her with a calculating look in his eyes. "Why are you here?" she questioned. He gestured to the house around them. Someone had to pack up all this stuff. The sneer from earlier ghosted across his lips. "No one ever expected you to come back." His gaze flickered to her hands. She flinched. "I didn't have a choice, did I?" "Didn't you?" he asked archly. "No one forced you to come back. You could have stayed wherever it was you were." The words were bitter and sharp. He blamed her. She flushed. "Someone had to take care of the estate," she said. She didn't tell him that it was her one opportunity to finally get some answers. She glanced at him. "I didn't know..." She shrugged, letting the sentence remain unfinished. She hadn't known he existed. When she got the call from the sheriff's office telling her that her family was dead, they hadn't mentioned him. As far as Kate had known, the line ended with her, disowned or not. He looked away from her, but she could still see the lines of pain etched into his face. Then, before she could register the change, the pain morphed into anger and he swung his hard gaze back to her. "Didn't know what?" he asked, his voice cutting. "That there was someone else who might claim the prize?" Anger flooded through her, irrational, self-righteous anger. This house wasn't a prize. He couldn't understand how it felt to live under the threat of her grandmother, always looking over her shoulder, expecting the lightning strike at every moment of her life. She balled her hands and felt the scars tighten. She tried not to remember the way the magic had felt flowing through her, but being in that house made the memories stronger. She shook as grief and anger warred within her. Henry watched her and said nothing, and that angered her even more. She opened her eyes, biting words on her tongue, but before she could speak, a howl rose from the depths of the house. It keened under the summer sun, a sound comprised of groaning beams and grinding stone. The floor beneath her feet shook and she lost her balance, collapsing against the table. Behind her, the pictures in their frames rattled against the wall, the large one of her mother and grandmother falling from its nail and landing inches from Kate's feet. It felt like the whole bulk of the house above her was swaying, and the sensation of the world moving without her made her stomach roll. She looked at Henry. He was clutching the edge of the table to keep himself upright. Outside, something crashed. Words of warning formed in her throat as emergency drills from school filled her head. They should get under the table. It would be safer. The table was a relic from the past, as long and thick as the tree it had been hewn from. As she opened her mouth to shout at him, the world stopped moving. At first, no movement was almost as disorienting as the movement itself had been. It felt like something wrong had happened, like something was missing. But then her head stopped spinning and gravity pulled her solidly back against the earth, grounding her. She breathed in deeply, pulling the scent of the house and her ghostly predecessor deep into her lungs. "Right," Henry said, pushing himself away from the table. "I can take a hint." Startled, Kate looked up at him. "What?" He ignored her and looked around the room, his expression clouded by contempt. "Is that what you want, you old hag?" He threw a sharp glance at her, still sagged against the table, shards of glass at her feet. "The princess can have her castle back." Kate wordlessly watched him stalk out the back door with a sense of bewilderment. Had he honestly thought an earthquake was a sign from the grave? She shook her head and carefully maneuvered herself away from the shards of broken glass. If he had, he hadn't known her family very well. She heard a car door slam through the open back door, then a rumble of an engine. She walked to the door and watched as a beat-up red pickup bounced over the uneven backyard before disappearing down the slope toward the road. "Welcome home, kiddo." "This isn't my home," she said to her mother's memory. The sentiment was bittersweet. Chapter 4. Tad. Her name was Simone Calhoun. "I was out in my garden, clipping mint before the full night set in," she said, taking a sip from her glass. "The garden faces Anne's house, and I noticed a lot of cars in the drive. Figured it was their family dinner. Ted nodded. The report had documented Mrs. Clark's account of the family's monthly tradition. "Anyways," Simone continued, "there was this big dark cloud over their house, but I didn't think anything of it until I heard this sound, like a bobcat. Only it was real low. When I looked up, the cloud over their house had turned black and was circling around the roof. I ran back inside and tried to call them, but I only got a busy signal, and by then it was too late." "So you saw the tornado touch down?" he asked, making a mental note to check the weather reports from that night. She sipped her tea and shook her head. "That was no tornado," she said. "That was a demon if I've ever seen one." Tad stopped writing and looked up at her. "A demon," he deadpanned. She nodded. "That's what I said." Even new on the job in a small rural town, Tad had already seen his share of crazy shit. He tried not to judge the people he met on the things they said, but it was hard not to scoff at her. "How do you know it was a demon?" he asked, trying like hell to keep his tone mild. He must have failed because she glared at him. "It had eyes," she said sharply. "Big fucking eyes I could see from my kitchen window." She pointed to the big paned window that was set against the western wall. He looked over his shoulder at it, considering the distance from that window to where the Dane house had stood. It was close to a quarter of a mile away at least. "What did you do then?" She shook her head and wouldn't meet his eyes. He thought he saw a flash of regret cross her profile. "There wasn't anything more I could do. I got my ass into my basement and waited until it was over. Then I called 911. Silence fell over them. He considered her words and what she probably wasn't saying. He didn't envy her just then. Fear was something everyone battled. He cleared his throat and shifted subject. "So, tell me about the demon." She shook herself free from her thoughts and stood to her feet. "Want a refill?" she asked, taking care not to look at him. He looked back at the coffee table where his glass sat untouched. "No, thank you." She nodded and walked back to the kitchen island where she opened the fridge and pulled herself another glass. Then she stood there, with her hands on the counter, her shoulders hunched into herself. He couldn't see her face. Her mass of curls obscured her features. "Miss Calhoun, are you all right?" he asked, alarmed. He half rose to his feet, unsure of the turn of disposition she'd just taken. "It looked like a massive snake," she said, still hidden by her hair and ignoring his question. Realizing she was lost in memory, he sat back down, feeling a little foolish. "It was huge," she continued, "as thick as my truck. I'd never seen anything like it before." Her shoulders shook and she sniffed. It dawned on him that she was crying. He shifted uncomfortably on the sofa, unsure of what to do. She saved him by pulling herself together and straightening. She flipped her hair back with one hand and wiped at her face with the other. "God, you think you know how you'll react in situations like that, but then they happen and all you can do is not pee your goddamn pants." "Trauma presents in a lot of different ways," he offered. "Everyone handles it differently." She looked at Tad then, spearing him with a clear gaze. He could see the words she wanted to say in her eyes. "You're too young. How would you understand?" Instead, she looked away from him and came back to her chair. "You don't believe me," she said, sitting down. It wasn't a question. It was closer to an accusation. He was absolutely certain that the giant snake demon was a figment of her imagination, but she believed it was real. He wasn't a psychologist, though, and for all he knew, saying that out loud might make things worse. "When I was a kid, my dad hit a dog with his car on our way home from a town council meeting," he said slowly, feeling the words as he spoke them. There was nothing he could have done. It was dark, and the dog came out of nowhere. As an adult, I know it was just a dog. But when I was a kid, I was convinced it was a werewolf. I had nightmares for months. Hell, I still have a phobia about big dogs." "What are you trying to say?" she asked, taking a long drink. From the way she knocked it back, he wondered if she'd spiked it with something when he wasn't looking. He shrugged. "Just that when we're scared, things look different." She set her glass down on the coffee table with a loud click of glass hitting glass and stood up, disappearing through a doorway. Tad's stomach dropped like lead. He'd said the wrong thing. He sighed and began to gather his things. Simone reappeared, holding a thick book. She dropped it on the coffee table in front of him, rattling the glasses. He looked up at her. He didn't know how she expected him to react. What am I looking at? She ignored him. Instead, she flipped the book to a section near the back and pointed at an illustration. This, she said vehemently, stabbing the picture with her finger. This is what it looked like. Tad leaned closer and read the inscription. Bashmu, the vicious torn viper. The snake in the picture reared before ant-sized men with tiny sharp spears. Its eyes were narrowed with hate and twin curving horns, as sleek as swords arced away from its head. Despite himself, Tad felt a shiver of fear thread its way down his spine. Chapter 5. Kate spent the rest of the afternoon digging through dressers and boxes. She searched everywhere she could think of, but in the end, there was nothing to be found, and inevitably, she found herself staring at the attic door. From the outside, the white door looked innocuous, so much that it blended into the walls to the point of being invisible. But Kate knew better. Beyond that door was the real seat of power. It was the place where her entire life had changed. It was the wound she picked at, never allowing it to heal. The door opened easily under her hand, and she couldn't shake the feeling that had been waiting for her. It opened inward, revealing time-worn stairs, the center of each bowed by passing of countless feet. Above her head, the wooden rafters were awash in golden sunlight, and the air smelled like warm wood and dried herbs. As she looked up the stairs, unable to see what awaited her on the floor above, deja vu trickled down her spine like ice water. The stairs creaked ominously under her weight as she ascended. There was no handrail, and she found herself bracing her hands against the rough wooden slats that lined the stairwell. Her grandmother's workroom only ran half the length of the house. Behind the stairs, a wall bisected the attic, and there was a closed door next to the stairwell that led to the other half. Kate didn't even need to try the handle to know it would be locked, and all the time she had lived there had never once been open. The window at the far end of the attic had been left open, and a breeze drifted through the dim room. Sunlight spilled through the glass and painted the wooden floor in shades of honey and amber. It was almost nice. She ran her fingers across the scarred wooden top of her grandmother's work table. Nothing had changed. Even the thick grimoire still sat in the middle of the table, just like the last time she'd seen it. Her eyes flickered to the floor. The only new object in the attic was the wide red rug that covered the wooden floorboards. She walked around the table, unable to take her eyes off that rug. Suspicion tickled at the back of her neck. When she was standing in the middle of the floor, her head barely clearing the beams overhead, she looked around. It was about the right place. A shiver rolled over her skin, bringing goose flesh despite the heat. Gingerly, she knelt on the rug and reached for the nearest corner. Nausea crawled up her throat as she peeled the edge back. The line of the outer circle appeared first, stark and black against the golden wood, like it had been burned into the surface. But no human hand had drawn that line. She knew if someone ever cared to measure, it would be a perfect circle. Her hands began to tremble as the runes appeared next, black as the circle line. When the inner circle appeared, stark white, she let go of the rug and scrambled backwards, putting as much distance between herself and the white circle. It was too much. She thought she'd been strong enough, but she had been wrong. Her throat turned thick, making it impossible to swallow. It was a mistake to come back. The floor beneath her wobbled, and the dried herbs that hung from the ceiling began to sway. Her sense of being anchored to the earth tilted. And then, without warning, she was drowning in memories of the past, of the last time she was in this room. It's the only way. She's my child. You're a granddaughter. She's a mistake. She should have never been created. Her hands hurt with remembered pain. She pushed herself to her feet and ran down the stairs to the second floor, but she didn't stop there. She ran down to the main floor and then out the door. She didn't bother locking it behind her. Henry could help himself to whatever he found in there. She didn't care anymore. That was a lie, of course, but it was one she told herself often enough that she almost believed it. Back in the car, she dumped her phone into the cup holder and tried to thread her keys into the ignition, but her hands were shaking too badly and she kept missing the slot. She forced herself to take a breath, to drag calm into her lungs. But in the space between one breath and the next, a sob escaped her chest, and then she was lost. She let her head fall against the steering wheel as her body shook under the hands of terror and grief. She grabbed the locket with her free hand and held onto it with a desperate grip, feeling too young, too alone. She could almost imagine the weight of her mother's hand on the back of her head. "You've always got me, kiddo." Kate dragged in a shaking breath. "You're gone," she said to the memory. "I'll never leave you," her mother's ghost murmured in the back of her mind. But Kate couldn't tell if the words came from her imagination or her memory. The house watched her impassionately, and she let go of the locket, glaring back at it. She shoved the keys into the ignition. "Fuck this," she said as the engine turned over. She glared at the shadow of the house before backing out of the driveway and turning around and coming back the way she'd come. With one hand at the wheel, she wiped the wetness on her cheeks. She glanced in her rearview mirror as she went around the bend, watching the house as it was obscured by the heavy branches of the dark trees. She had expected to feel relief, but instead, something heavy settled over her shoulders as the house disappeared from view. She let the car pick up more speed, trying to outrun the feeling. The locket felt like a weight around her throat, and she rubbed the back of her neck, trying to ease the phantom sensation. The Clark farmstead flew by outside her window as the car bounced over the uneven dirt road. She mentally winced at the onslaught of rocks and potholes, but she didn't dare slow down. The urge to get off the hill was nearly a physical thing, and it made her hands shake. Her mother was right. She should have never come back. Kate glanced in the rearview mirror one more time as the car neared the creek, watching the thick tangle of trees obscure her view of the road. It was like watching dirt being thrown on top of a grave. No sadness, no relief, just numbness and a vague sense of impatience. Her stomach growled and she had an intense flush of desire for fast food, something greasy, something to tell her she was alive. She just wanted to leave it all behind. A rush of electricity ran down her arms and pooled in her hands, a memory of the magic she used to have. It brought with it old remembered pain that pricked at her fingers. She clenched the steering wheel harder, steeling her jaw against the hurt. But the memory of pain blossomed into real pain, and she gasped at the sudden sensation of skin tearing. The steering wheel grew hot under her hands. It took her a second to realize that it wasn't the steering wheel that was hot. It was her hands. It felt like they were on fire. "Kate!" Something beeped from the dashboard same time the engine stuttered. Her tension flew back to the car, and her pain was eclipsed by the sudden flash of fear as the interior dash lights blinked and then died. The engine stopped. An unnatural silence fell over the car as it continued down the road, no longer propelling itself, but instead falling down the slope. Too late, she realized it had veered off course. She panicked and hit the brakes, but nothing happened. She yanked the wheel to the side, but without power steering, it did almost no good. Before she could register what was happening, the front of the car slammed into the ancient stone bridge that crossed the creek, and the momentum jerked Kate forward as her seatbelt tightened painfully across her chest. The sidewall of the bridge crumbled under the force of the impact, and the little red rental and its occupant fell through the air, plummeting into the water below. The world fell into stillness. Chapter 6. Tad. In the end, he left her with his card, telling her to give him a call if she needed to talk, or if she saw anyone poking around the wreckage. The image had stirred something basic in him, and he was anxious to leave. The drive back to East Huntington wasn't long, but he couldn't get the image of the snake out of his head. In an effort to distract himself, he ran through a mental list of things he needed to do before he clocked out for the day. He pulled into the station's parking lot and killed the engine. His dad's truck wasn't there. That wasn't a surprise. His dad hadn't done a full day's work since Tad was in high school. These days, if it wasn't hunting, his dad wasn't interested. Tad nodded to Carl on his way through the reception and made his way to his desk in the back corner of the small room that served as a workplace for the officers. It wasn't really a desk, more like a table that had been repurposed to give him a place for to put his things. When he sank into his chair, it leaned back dangerously far before he shifted his weight forward. He'd never tested the chair to see if it would actually topple over, but he didn't feel like testing his luck today. The first thing he did was check the weather reports for Tuesday night. As he sifted through the reports from the local meteorological center, his mind kept wandering back to Simone Calhoun, her matter-of-fact way of talking about demons. It struck him as abnormal, but his gut told him that something was going on there. He pulled up the records of the local citizens and entered her name into the computer. Nothing came back, not even a speeding ticket. "Hey, Mike," he called to the portly salt and pepper man sitting on the other side of the room. They were the only two officers there just then, but it still took a second call for the older man to respond. It was little things like that that got to him. Before he joined the force, Mike had been an uncle to him, but now he barely acknowledged Tad's presence. Mike sighed loudly. "What's up, kid?" "Know anything about Simone Calhoun? She lives up on Black River Road next to the house that exploded." "You still working that?" Mike sounded cross. "I thought the fire marshal's office was taking over." "Just following up the 911 call. So, Calhoun, know anything?" Mike leaned back and scratched the stubble along his jaw. "Her name sounds familiar. I think I went to school with her. Or maybe someone else in her family. She got any siblings?" Tad shrugged. Carla came around the corner from her desk at reception, her arms full of folders. Carla may have been old enough to be Tad's mother, but that didn't stop her from dressing like she was still 16. Her flip-flops smacked against the bottom of her feet as she walked, and her fruity perfume immediately filled the small room. "Hey, Carla," Mike said, drawing her attention. "Does the name Simone Calhoun mean anything to you?" She flopped several files in front of Mike. "Sure." Tad perked up. "You know her?" She nodded. "Yeah, I dated her brother back in the day." She shook her head. "That whole family is batshit crazy." That was just what he was afraid of. Tad sank back into his chair and it wobbled under his weight. "What kind of crazy?" Mike asked. "Regular crazy or crazy crazy?" Carla snorted and handed a single folder to Tad. He flipped it open. It was the next week's assignments. He put it aside. "Dancing under the moon talks to crystals kind of crazy," she said. Mike grunted. "One of those then." She nodded. Tad looked between them. He was missing something. "I don't get it," he said. "One of what?" They looked at each other, sharing a glance. "Nothing," Mike said the same time Carla said, "witches." Tad frowned at them. "Witches," he repeated. Mike scowled at Carla. "They're not witches." She shrugged. "They think they are." While Carla and Mike agreed to disagree on the topic, Tad tapped his pen against his lips, mulling over what he knew about Simone. The demon thing definitely leaned towards the whole witch idea, but he didn't know that much more about the woman other than she liked plants and burnt incense. Still, it sat on his mind. Tad's girlfriend in college had liked to frequent a shop that catered to the mystic crowd, selling everything from crystals and dried herb blends to pentagrams and occult statues. Anne had liked the delicate hanging glass globes they sold. The owners were a mother and daughter pair of hippies that had always smelled like patchouli and weed. When he thought about it, Simone Calhoun reminded him of that mother and daughter. Maybe he was just grasping onto stereotypes, but at least it was something. The phone in the corner of his desk lit up, the blinking light indicating that it was Carla back at the front desk. He picked up the handset. "What's up?" he asked. "I got a call on line one for you." "Who is it?" "Didn't say." And then, before he could say anything else, she hung up and the line immediately transferred to him out with an audible click. "This is Officer Shannon," he said into the receiver, scrambling to find a pencil amid the papers cluttering his desk. "Hi," Simone Calhoun said quickly. Her voice shook like she'd had too much coffee. She rushed on before he could greet her, her words fast and running into one another. "You told me to call you any time if something looked out of place?" He sat up straighter and the chair wobbled beneath him. "What's happening?" He could hear her hesitation and the nervous breaths she took. Then she spoke. "It's back." And that concludes our reading selection. This was fun, and I hope you enjoyed it too. If you're interested in the rest of the story, it's currently being released on Kindlevella, one episode every week, Mondays. Kindlevella can be found on the Kindle app on iOS devices or in your web browser. Unfortunately, as of right now, they don't have it on Android yet, So to make things a little easier, I'm going to drop a direct link to the story in the show notes, which you can always find at readandwritepodcast.com. If you have any other feedback, I'd love to hear from you. Drop me a line on Twitter at rnwpodcast or my own personal Twitter account, dmzbarth. So join Jocelyn and me next time when we're going to talk about procrastination. Until then, stay safe, keep writing, keep reading, and go do what you do best. And that's it. Thank you for listening to the show. If you like what you're hearing, make sure to rate Read and Write on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you have a suggestion for a future episode, drop me a line. I'm always open to suggestions. Also, did you know that Read and Write publishes 3 episodes a week? Check out the podcast's YouTube channel for Write With Me Mondays live streams and 30-second book reviews on Fridays.